saint, maybe might be nice.
Hey there, and welcome to the very first episode of Dear Uncle Tony, the literary arts and storytelling podcast of the Zi chapter of St. Anthony Hall. I'm your host, Kate Goodnight, Zi 2002. Our goal with this podcast is to bring Zi brethren closer together by collecting and spreading our work to St. A's all over the world. So we're going to have a little bit of everything for you. Original music, poetry, and essays, Hall stories, both new and old, and interviews with Zi alumni. Also, this is a podcast for adults, so be prepared for some salty, salacious, or irreverent language. Without further ado, I'm going to jump right into this first episode with an original poem from Sister Lee Tuckman, sent to us all the way from Sydney, Australia.
And I listen, and I listen, didn't answer right away, did not have a lot to say.
The Muse. The sleep is the first thing to go. Then the food. Then she turns up on your doorstep, gray cashmere sweater and warm blue jeans, smiling that funny little half-smile. Like she knows she's imposing, she's sorry she's come, like she's got nowhere else to go. An old friend with hungry eyes. She carries the usual gifts, a ream of paper and a pair of walking shoes. And you can leave her out there, you can refuse to let her in, but then what if she just sits on the stoop, waiting? Or what if she leaves and never returns? You've had days to think about it, all that time you've spent awake and not eating. You let her in. You always do. You get out your pen while she sips her tea. You want to ask, how long are you staying for this time? But the answer is always the same. Wait and see. Instead, you say, they tell me the other ladies show up with music and laughter. She arches an eyebrow. Do they now? You stay up writing through the night. She sleeps in your bed, and she eats off your plate. You go out walking in the new shoes, and she's put chalk in the pockets of your coat, just in case. You come home and stand in the shower until the water runs cold, red bleeding out of your hair and down the drain. She passes you the towel and pulls down the shade. The dishes pile up, and the days. You burn through the paper and the soles of the shoes, and she's still hanging around. You sit in the corner and watch the shadows move across the wall. She watches you. When the sun is gone and the shadows fill the room, you speak without looking at her. I could leave. As you have done before, she replies, her voice sympathetic. The first time you left, she had stayed for a year. The second time, 2 years, and you ran farther. She found you anyway. Leave it be, she says. Come to bed. You lie in the dark, staring at the ceiling. The weight of her head pressing down on your chest, limiting your breathing. Maybe, in the morning, she'll be gone.
And there is something great about having people snap at what you say.
Now, let's check in with Brother Michael Williams, who recently shared a story at an alumni event about his time as an undergraduate at UNC.
Sister Garner, Kelly Jo Garner, I realize that everybody calls her KJ, and I guess everybody has always called her KJ, but her name is Kelly Jo, and so I call her Kelly Jo. We both came to UNC under a program that existed at the time that the legislature were not total shits, called North Carolina Teaching Fellows. And we were both going to be teachers, and it's kind of entertaining to me to imagine Kelly Jo is a high school French teacher, and I'm a middle school math teacher, and, you know, we've got, like, apples on our desks and extremely complicated lives we try to keep our students from finding out about on Facebook. But in winter break of 1994-1995, neither of us had joined the hall yet, and we had the opportunity to go on a trip to Russia. This trip to Russia was totally, I'll spoil the ending by saying it was amazing, but it was also doomed from the get-go. Abruptly, about 10 weeks before our trip, in a day or two, the Russian economy was totally collapsing, and the U.S. State Department nearly canceled our trip, and it was all really chaotic, and I had wanted to be a Sovietologist until the Soviet Union ceased to exist when I was a senior in high school. So then I couldn't be a Sovietologist anymore. But then everything kind of came together at the last second, and then off we go. And, like, getting there was this really complicated experience. you could smoke on planes at the time, and there was this whole, like, disco in the back of the plane, basically, as, like, two-thirds of the plane packed into the last three rows and lit up cigarettes for this 12-hour flight. And from the get-go, we were having a lot of experiences we had not expected. Like the cadre of Mormon missionaries who were seated in front of us who made the mistake of telling us that they weren't allowed to touch women. And the rest of the flight was a bunch of women trying really hard to touch the Mormon missionaries. It was really great. So we get to Russia. We have all these language difficulties in Russia because I had learned the Cyrillic alphabet well enough to sound it out. But I didn't actually speak Russian. And we kept having all these experiences where our host families would assume that we were learning Russian while we were there for 2 weeks. Like on New Year's Eve, my host father took me on a tour of the neighbor's apartment and pointed out this big poster, and I sounded out Moscow Symphony Orchestra. And then he looked at me and said the only words in English he said the entire time, which were, "You speak Russian." And I said, and then we were best friends, and I have no idea what we talked about for the next 3 hours. I just emphatically agreed and disagreed and said that I was from France. And, you know, things like that happened a lot. And we had on the trip this guy named Dmitry. Dmitry was our chaperone. He kept being the guy who would handle things when we would run into the KGB. When we say run into the KGB, I don't mean that that happened because we were special. I mean that happened because we were in Russia. And you have no idea how large the surveillance state was and continued to be after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because like everybody, basically, was on the payroll of the KGB. It was a sport to inform on people so that you could get a bonus. So we always were joking, like, "Ha, Dmitry is with KGB." Dmitry was like this character out of a mid-century novel that was meant to point out the hypocrisies of the Soviet Union. He was this guy who was like really dashingly good-looking. Mostly what he did was he sat around and told us about his girlfriend and his wife and his apartment in Moscow and his house in the Black Sea and this really complicated life he had. And he smoked a lot of American cigarettes. I had taken a lot of American cigarettes. There was the stereotype at the time that you could bribe your way into anything in Russia with American denim. And that was true. So I took a couple of cartons of Camels and figured I would just buy my way into whatever I needed to buy my way into. So we're in Moscow for a week. And then we all pile onto a train that's an overnight train to go from Moscow to spend a week in St. Petersburg. The car that we were on was mostly people from our scholarship program. It was Kelly Joe and me and 10 other students from UNC and this one random staffer from the School of Education who was the administrative assistant for our program, and he had been drafted to be our chaperone for the trip, and he was kind of in over his head. So we're on the train, and we ask about where to smoke on the train because, you know, we're Americans and we're at the time getting used to having to ask where you can smoke. But in Russia, I'm pretty sure you could smoke anywhere because, like, everybody in Russia smoked. Much to our surprise, the steward on the train told us that we were not allowed to smoke in the train car. We had to go to the smoking place. You went down a long hallway on the train, just like a train in the movie, and then you went through a door, and then there was this little area that was not climate-controlled at all, and it was January, and we were traveling north in Russia. And it wasn't also totally sealed, and so there was kind of snow like piling up on the floor around you, but it was also supposedly inside, and the Russians were all going to make fun of you if you like bundled up to go to the smoking place. Kelly Joe and I were spending a lot of time in the smoking place. And we're standing there in the smoking place smoking, like you do. And Dmitry comes into the smoking place, and three of the other five people who were on our car, four of them being these Russian federal police guys who were in these really complicated uniforms, the hat and everything, and the fifth being this other American who is totally unattached, has nothing to do with us or our trip. And he proceeded to harass everyone on the trip. So we were getting really tired of this guy by hour, like, three. And Dmitry is talking to three of these Russian federal cops who are standing there smoking with us. And Dmitry very casually turns to me and says, "Would you like police to take care of American that you hate?" And Kelly Joe and I looked at each other, and I said, "When you say take care of," and he says, "Not hurt. So what would I need to exchange for that?" And then there's some quiet Russian negotiation on our behalf. And then Dmitri turns back to me and says, "Rip the pack of cigarettes." And so I looked at my 3/4 of a pack of Camels and thought, I've got 2 more cartons in the luggage. And I held them out, and one of the Russian police took them from my hand. And then Dmitri says, "You made the right choice." And we smoke our cigarettes, and Kelly, Jeff, and I are silent. Just totally stone sober, silent. And they finish my cigarettes and put the pack in their pocket, and then they leave the smoking place. And Dmitri just looks out the window in perfect silence. And Kelly Jo and I look out the door of the smoking place up the hallway. And they walked up to the American's door, and they slam on it with their fists. And the door opens, and then they reach in, and they pull the guy out bodily, and then they just drag him down the car, all the way down the car, to their compartment, fling him in, walk in, shut the door after themselves, and we never see them for the rest of the night. So Kelly Jo and I are like, we've gotten a dude murdered. For 3/4 of a pack of candy. And now we've realized that the spectrum between horrifying and awesome is a circle. It turns out he lived, but they did tell him that he needed to be quiet or he wouldn't. But he got cranky at some point in the night, and so they made the train stop. And it was in this little town, I guess, in Russia somewhere. And we looked out the windows when the train stopped, because it's supposed to be a non-stop ride. And there were like 40 dudes in these cop uniforms. And I'm like, this is going to be a lot of cigarettes. They apparently like threatened the guy with, you know, we're going to throw you off the train and these guys are going to take care of you. Nobody's ever going to hear from you again. And so then he calmed down and then everybody went about their business and we got moving again, went the rest of the trip to St. Petersburg. Dmitri kept being this sort of hilariously cartoonish figure in our lives. And we're in a museum in St. Petersburg. I think it was the Museum of the People of the Soviet Union. It was this museum where they had wax models of all the native peoples of the Soviet Union that had been murdered so Russians could move there. Somebody asked something of Dmitri about what was written on a plaque that's way down on the ground. And the handgun in his waistband popped out from under his jacket. And 12 American teenagers and their staffer from the School of Education all went, and Dmitri very slowly stood up, pulled his jacket back down around it, and then read the sign. And nobody said a word, because then we knew that Dmitri really was KGB, and that's why the cops were willing to do it for 3/4 of a pack of cigarettes instead of a lot more. Respectfully submitted.
Sounds like Sister Garner and Brother Williams got the best possible deal out of that one. Who says cigarettes are all bad? Certainly not sibling Salem Dockery, which she makes clear in her poem, Tour Group M.
Hi, my name is Salem Dockery, and the poem I'm about to read is called Tour Group M. It's kind of about how much I hate when old rich white people come onto campus showing around their children as prospective students. It's one of my favorites. It gets about 50-50 reviews because I think it's hilarious, but it's kind of inappropriate for all venues, which is also part of why I love it. So this is Tour Group Him. Nothing makes me rile up like a waspy tour group walking around campus. I want to blow the smoke of my cigarette in the mothers' faces, tell the fathers to lock up their daughters, emote and ooze punk ass that makes the parents quiver at the prospect of me positioning myself as your little girl's friend, and your little girl quivering in literally every other position I would have her in. It's not the 70s, I say, and you're not a legacy anymore. Forget the frat boys, let me be the supplemental ed to the MRS you'll send her off for. And I will send her home with hairy armpits longer than the hair on her head, and heartbroken, but she can't tell you about the older girl who said, "We're just at different places in our lives, I don't want to be tied down right now, and I think we should see other people when she'd already seen me seeing somebody else." She'll still wear flannel shirts, exchanging Jane Eyre for Sylvia Plath. She might even transfer to a women's college, and someday she won't even think of me when she yet again refuses to let feminist discourse be phased out yet. And let's not forget your sons! because soon my counterculture Hulk will smash all your skewed views of manhood, shattering them like baseballs through glass windows. Know your golden boys, they won't play sports anymore as much as they scoff and sigh, because it's Thanksgiving and suddenly they won't shut the fuck up about that damn catcher in the rye. If we do our job right, they'll drink wine in the morning and fashion themselves Socrates and Bukowskis. They'll think they should have been a sailor, and the salty brine will reek on their clothes when probably actually it's just weed. But you and the missus don't talk about this when he brings home his laundry for the holiday weekend. And while we're talking about plants, maybe now it's time to tug at your roots and all the other seeds that never took when you were a wild-eyed youth. Was it your mother and father who looked down on you with their noses high up above us? Or did you have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, never having the privilege of being a punk fuck-up? Do you feel it in your spine or soul, or maybe in the weight of your pocket, to see us and realize that maybe once we were also somebody's hopefuls? Sucks to suck, man. That's hella legit sentiment, but totally not quite the case. Not every kid in this generation is stuck between a YOLO and a beat phase. We often assume of others what we know to be true of ourselves. So take a look good and hard. I'll even crack open a PBR and let my American spirit waft with the frisbee contrails across the quad. You were only in college once. It's not my fault you never took the time to trip on these shared bricks we trod. You roll up your windows as you drive away. Tell your kids not to make any plans yet. You don't want all this fresh air to go to their heads. For now you leave, but before you go, see me proclaiming Eulalia. You look like someone who supports Greenpeace and longboarding into the sunset. I made a pledge, I made a promise. I am a pledge, yes, I am a promise.
My name is Dallas Hopkins, I am Xi 15. I am from Detroit, Michigan, here out of state. Currently studying art history and Italian. I'm going to be reading a poem for you. It is something I wrote for my pledge project. I wrote it as I was coming into the hall, and it's sort of about what the hall was for me at that time, and sort of, you know, like getting accustomed and getting used to what the vibe of the hall is like and just the things that it requires. So here we go. Whether the weather be cold, whether the weather be hot, you'll weather the weather, whatever the weather, whether you like it or not. Sunlight streams through the window, drips down my face like candle wax. At once the sun is extinguished, bringing the room into black. I breathe in the darkness, coating my lungs with tar. Inhale, exhale, they're getting a delicious char. I feel a ghost of a hand on my shoulder, and another pulls my wrist. I follow into their Cimmerian night, not thinking to resist. They lead me through a forest, then through fields of snow. I walk, I walk, I walk, I walk, not sure how much farther I can go. Suddenly I am stopped and pushed to my knees. The wind sounds like the clearing of throats, and once again I can see. Empty eye sockets stare from heavy black hoods. The leader, I assume, steps out and says, "We will not be misunderstood." I wait for more direction, my body tense with fear. The chieftain steps back in the circle, and all of the skeletons disappear. I'm shrouded freshly in darkness, and the ghostly hands return. They lift me to my feet, but they're no longer taciturn. It begins with just a whisper, the tickle of W's on my face. The voice behind the hands gets louder, and I begin to quicken my pace. The hands push me on, and the chanting begins. This time, it's many. All of the skeletons have joined in. I'm running now, but I don't know where. The hands still lead me, holding me within their care. We've reached our destination, and I'm under the skeleton's leer. I kneel before the hands, and all that I can hear is, whether the weather be cold, whether the weather be hot, you'll weather the weather, whatever the weather, whether you like it or not.
And that was Brother Dallas Hopkins reading Weather the Weather. And finally, something totally different. On Dear Uncle Tony, we're planning to have a regular segment of job interviews with alumni. When I say job interviews, we'll talk to alums about their current jobs, their academic work at UNC, and the trajectory their careers have taken since leaving school. For our first interview, I spoke with Sister Noelle Ocon, who works with the NC Museum of Art in Raleigh.
This is Kate, and I'm just going to let you introduce yourself, name, pledge class, where you live.
All right. So name, Noelle Ocon, pledge class, 1986, and I live in Durham, North Carolina.
Nice. And Noe, what did you study while you were at Chapel Hill?
I studied art history for the first 2 years, and then I decided that I wanted to go into conservation, so all of my electives were chemistry, so I have a concentration in chemistry as well.
Cool. So is that something that you discovered while you were at school, or is that something that you were interested in general?
Well, I say I had a eureka moment. It was the end of my sophomore year, and I had just declared art history as a major. And I went to a meeting about careers for art historians. So like I say, it was a very short meeting because there are not a lot of careers. But I met a conservator there, and I don't remember her name. She went to the NYU program, and she had this pamphlet. And I said, that's what I want to do. And it was like a calling.
Cool.
And from that moment on, things got real. I got really serious about school, and just I went all out on that path. And it was all about achieving that.
So it seems to have worked out pretty well for you, because I know what you do, but I'm going to let you tell everybody sort of in your own words and layman's terms what you do for a living now.
Okay. Currently, I'm the conservator of paintings at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh, North Carolina. So the sexy part of what I do is the restoration process, where we clean paintings and restore the paintings, sort of like what you see in popular media. That's what we do, but it's only a small part of what we do. And what I say is conservation is an umbrella term for preservation, documentation, and then restoration, okay?
Gotcha.
And examination, that's the other one. So what we do is we look at the painting holistically, from front to back, top to bottom, side to side, because the first part of it is we are examining the object. How is it made? When was it made? What was it made of? And we use all sorts of techniques to do that, microscopy, X-radiography, infrared reflectography. So that's all sort of the examination process. And we basically create a report giving the history as we know it of that painting. And then the other part is preservation, which is how do we preserve that work of art as it is today? So simple things like making sure the environment is okay, the light levels are okay, it's hanging on the wall securely, things like that. And then we do the documentation process, which is part of the examination, where we do different kinds of photography, and we can do different other examination techniques. It's the not fun part. That's like writing a report. And you know, sometimes I struggle with how many ways to say it's oil paint on a piece of canvas, in different ways. Anyway.
Right. Everybody was kind of doing the same thing at the same time. And
exactly. And then we get to the restoration process, and that is the part I enjoy the most. And that is the cleaning and the restoring it and making it look better. Most paintings up until, let's say, the late 19th century, when you get into Impressionism, paintings were varnished. And varnish is basically tree sap. And it undergoes a chemical change that makes it yellow. So when you see that old master glow of a painting, that's not the paint layer. That's the varnish layer. And these paintings, there's not an old master painting in our museum that has not been restored at some point. And sometimes we find evidence of 4 or 5 restorations over the course of 400 or 500 years. Of course, what we would like to do is stop that process by using new technologies and techniques so that we stop or at least slow down that restoration cycle is what we call it. Because you are putting the painting through stress each time you work on it. So, for example, the most important thing we use is synthetic varnishes that do not yellow. And that is one of the most important things that have been developed just in the last 20 or 30 years. there were acrylic varnishes that did not yellow starting in the 60s, but they didn't have good optical properties. So these
cool, so they kind of distort the painting.
Exactly. Well, what they do is they come gray and fuzzy. What you want is you want your paint layer to be saturated. And the way I describe saturation is take your wooden deck, and when it's wet, that's saturated. It deepens the color and all that. So
right.
By using these new synthetic resins that have good optical properties, we are slowing that restoration cycle.
Cool. So you guys are essentially like doctors for paintings. You're first doing no harm and then getting everybody into this nice place of homeostasis, and so you still exist on that same original level, but then also you're not going to have to necessarily alter it that much in the future.
Right. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That's a very good
cool.
way to put it. Some paintings are pretty much straightforward, but through our examination techniques, I've been able to have different discoveries. You're always finding extra heads under paintings, and I found like
sure.
5 or 6 extra heads where the artist had painted it out. And we can see that in infrared and x-ray. And I actually found Moses last year in a painting. He was covered up in the mountains, and it was a scene of the worship of the golden calf. And
okay.
part of that biblical story is Moses is in the mountains and is going to throw the tablets down. And he
right.
has been covered up, and so I uncovered him. Now we have Moses.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Nice. So he was there all along. He was just hiding.
Yeah.
You can't hide from the eyes of God, guys.
Or a conservator.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, I was going to ask you about technology and stuff like that. Is there anything in particular that you really like, or is there something new that's coming up on the scene that you're kind of excited about or maybe even wary about?
Well, the big catchphrase is non-destructive testing, okay? And that is what we want. So for many years, let's say we wanted to study a cross-section of the painting.
Sure.
You would have to take a piece of the painting off, and it's destructive. That little piece of paint is very, very small, a few millimeters, but
right.
it's gone. It can no longer be part of the painting. So what we're developing now is ways of doing virtual cross-sections using new technology. So one of the first steps was back in 2004. I went to Cornell to the particle accelerator there. It's called CHESS, Cornell High Energy Synchrotron Source. And
wow.
we developed a way to focus x-rays so that you can thin slice the painting and determine the paint of each layer. It's very cool, but you need a particle accelerator to do that.
Right, and the knowledge to operate one, too,
right.
I would imagine.
Right. So now at Duke, we are working with a team there to develop something called pump probe technology, and it's still in its infancy. We are going to hopefully be able to come up with a machine, a portable machine, that will do that for you. Because right now there is portable x-ray fluorescence, but it doesn't thin slice the painting, so to speak. What it does is gives you all the data for the whole layer of paint. So let me describe that. So initially, let's say a traditional oil on canvas. There would be a white lead ground layer. Then there
okay.
might be an imprimatur or a dead coloring that might be done in an iron oxide. And then the artist works up his paints using different materials, lead white, vermilion, ultramarine, azurite, malachite, all these different paints.
So,
but you have many layers. When you use a portable XRF, you cannot distinguish where each layer is.
Right,
that,
so you're basically just getting an amalgam of everything that's there. You still have to do the work to separate that.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so that's one of the things that we're trying to develop. And then I'm actually working on a very exciting program, and this was a process of working with another Duke department of electrical engineers and mathematicians. So one of the issues we have with a panel painting, there are many, many paintings on wood, and wood was very popular support in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. But over time, a restorer oftentimes would support that wood with a wooden latticework on the back. So it helps the front, but when I x-ray it, the cradle pattern gets in the way. The mathematicians created an algorithm And then we're working with some programmers at the Free University of Brussels who are making it into a code. And then we hired some people who work with Adobe to create a plugin to digitally remove the cradle. It's of global use. I mean, every museum with old master collections has paintings with cradles. And we have struggled with how to get better x-rays since Röntgen created x-rays, or not created, sorry, discovered. But
you might as well have created them. Nobody knew anything about them before. So
I know. But this is just very exciting if it works.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's episode. But be sure to tune in to episode 2 for the next installment of my interview with Noelle Ocon. Thanks for joining me for this inaugural episode of Dear Uncle Tony. Special thanks to Brother Michael Williams, Sister KJ Garner, Brother Josh Heisey, Sister Hannah Jones, and to all of the contributors you heard on the show today. The music you heard on the podcast is Ode to St. Anthony by Sister Charlotte Parrott, and you can listen to the song in its entirety at the end of the show. This podcast is a production of the Siblings of St. Anthony Hall's Side Chapter and is presented by the St. Anthony Association of North Carolina. The show is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. If you'd like to contribute content to the show, you can email us at DearUncleTony1847@gmail.com or leave a message on our Google Voice line at 919-709-DEAR. That's 919-709-DEAR. If you'd like to donate to the podcast or the Zai chapter, you can do so at www.stanthonync.org/donate. Thanks again for listening. Respectfully submitted.
Yes, I am a promise.